I should begin with a thanks too. This opportunity has been a wonderful one for me to find out more about community leadership, about what you're all doing out in your communities. And it strikes me that as I've come to reacquaint myself with what Rhonda and the team at our community have been doing, that that whole initiative is a very good example of liberating leadership. So I think we don't need to go very far to find plenty of inspiration today. But what do I mean by liberating leadership? I mean two things. Firstly, I want to argue that leadership needs to be liberated from itself, and in particular from a received wisdom, which is, I believe, increasingly narrow, corporate-inspired, and individualistic in its focus. Leadership has really come to be something that everybody seems to be expected to be doing. Right through from CEOs to school children, everybody's being expected to show leadership. So this brings with it a problem that it's ubiquitous and indeed, in a sense, almost banal. So what you see often happening with our words and our language around leadership is that it becomes what I've described as McDonaldized. So it has the sort of seductive look, it's sort of a bit familiar, the language. It's often sort of loaded with apparently good things, you know, visions and values. But it's curiously unsustaining. There's a sense in which a lot of the talk about leadership is curiously superficial. It really doesn't get at the complexity, the tension, the contradiction, the conflict that's often at the heart of good leadership work, of powerful leadership work. So what I think, you know, part of why leadership needs to be liberated from itself is that it needs to be liberated from these rather banal and massaged, manufactured notions of leadership that we've come to have inflicted on us. And I'm sure you have as well as me. And it's extensively documented in the number of sort of leadership training programs that there are out there now. I mean, it seems that everybody's doing training to do leadership, or everybody's involved in this kind of activity. You know, one of our good commentators on leadership research, and I look at a lot of leadership research, as you'd imagine, says that never have so many laboured so long to say so little. So he's talking about the leadership literature there. It's curiously unappetising and not very helpful. So I think that we need some new ideas about leadership, and I'm looking to this group and to the next 2 days to help us do that. Second, I think we need to... the second way in which I think leadership needs to be liberated from it... leadership needs to be liberating is that leadership needs to free people. So the purpose of leadership should be about supporting others to act, mobilising people to head in new directions, supporting people to value themselves, their families, their communities, opening minds to new possibilities. So the purpose of leadership, it seems to me, should be about liberation. It should be about freedom. And yet, very, very often, you know, in my observation, in my experience, leadership does the reverse. What I mean by that is that it often enslaves people. It often seems to quarantine them into working in ways that are unsustainable, that are disconnected to what's really going on. Leadership often seems to compel people to think they've got to do the great heroic quest, that they've got to be single-handedly producing visions and marching off over the horizon. So all of these forces around leadership, I think, often end up trapping people and enslaving them rather than freeing them. So the thing that I want to explore today a little more is how to do leadership in ways that genuinely free people. And I think that the way to do that is to step back and get a bigger picture on leadership. I think it's not until we do that that we actually start to unshackle ourselves from what I believe are very constraining ideas about leadership. So I hope that I can help with that process a little bit today. I want to talk about what I've called five myths about leadership and the liberating leadership alternatives. So myth number one. Here, the myth is that leadership is always a good thing. So increasingly what we get are people simply calling for leadership. Much leadership thinking simply assumes that leadership is a good thing and we just need more of it. Now, this really troubles me because what it does is it encourages a certain silence around the purposes to which that leadership is put. So, of course, an enormous amount of the leadership that we encounter and that certainly I encounter in my work in the business school are actually about advancing the interests of global capital. That's what they're about. That's what that leadership's all about. But that's not really made truly explicit. And it's often the costs of that agenda are not made explicit either. So, an important part of doing this work of thinking about leadership again is in making sure we have the purposes to which our leadership is put right front and centre of our attention. When I first started thinking about leadership, I thought the answers must lie in Harvard Business School cases. You see, I work in a business school. And so what happens in that kind of environment is that you are often offered the CEOs of large multinational businesses as exemplars of leadership. So the most common one that I was exposed to was a fellow called Jack Welch, also known as Neutron Jack. He was the CEO of GE, huge, very successful, enormously successful multinational based in the US. He's now the chairman. He has actually retired from the CEO's position. But I used to sit in audiences, not quite as big as this, but, you know, largish audiences, watching videos and watching people talk about Jack. And, and people would see leadership and... Look, what I saw was this fairly sharp-talking person, fond of baseball and basketball analogies, talking about how important it was to be tough, you know? And look, I didn't see leadership. Initially, I really sort of censored my own response. I thought, well, look, if everybody else is seeing it there, you know, maybe it's a problem with me. But... more and more, I've come to think that it's not a problem with me, that we really do need to ask questions about what happens when we get held up as exemplars for us of great leaders, people like that. And look, I don't want to hop into Jack too much. It is a little bit tempting. You might have read probably about a year ago now. He has retired from GE, but he has an amazingly generous package as part of that, and there was a little brief kerfuffle because he had fresh flowers being delivered to his apartment in New York just in case he ever happened to drop in there, and there was sort of some complaint about the costs of those sorts of perks. So it was briefly in the news, but not for very long. So we need to ask who we're being offered as exemplars of leadership. And if you've ever been involved in leadership development programs, you probably would have been exposed to some corporate leaders as examples. You might have been encouraged to look at great adventurers, like people like Shackleton and so on. Now, I'm not saying that these aren't valuable exercises, nor that some of these individuals haven't delivered some great leadership, or even that they haven't got things that they can teach us. My point is that in all this fuss about leadership, we've sometimes been seduced by the possibility that leadership holds out. I think we are often seduced by leaders who seem to act as though they've got the answers. And as the recent Enron case, I don't know how many of you have been following that, but I've been enormously interested in that, of course, given my interests. You know, that was a classic example of two leaders who managed to seduce everybody, you know, from the most senior levels of government, the White House, right down, into believing that there was an answer to making more money. And what happens is that, you know, shareholders, everybody gets seduced by this process. And the leaders themselves get seduced in a process of what I call double seduction, where the leaders get seduced by their own powers of seduction. It's a very dangerous cocktail. So all these are reasons, going back to that first myth, to be very thoughtful about our purposes, to keep on articulating and reconnecting with them, to make sure they're worth leading for. And some of those purposes we need to revalue, purposes like well-being and happiness, not just material goals. We need to keep on valuing the interests of the least well-endowed and not simply assume that there'll be some kind of trickle-down effect or the cake will be bigger and everybody will benefit. So that sort of discipline around purposes, I think, is a very important part of the work of liberating leadership. Let me move on to the second myth. Leadership is a single-handed heroic performance by a visionary individual. It's often assumed that leadership is about conjuring up the great vision, here it is, and then leading the group to the great vision. Well, in fact, all of the evidence is that it's often the work of leadership to support the group to define the vision. You know, the best visions are always open to adaption and change. Let me talk a little bit about Christine Nixon here, because she's a person who I've done some work with. She, for those of you who are not Victorians, is the Chief Commissioner of Police in Victoria. And she tells the story that when she was being hired for the job, Steve Brax, the Premier, said to her, "What's your vision for Victoria Police?" Now, this is a really common question, you know, in job interviews. This is what people get asked all the time, you know, what's your vision and how are you going to lead us there? And Christine said, "Well, I don't know. I'll have to talk to some people." It's a very, you know, unusual thing to do. And what she then did was talk to people, and she didn't mean just talk to the usual Pollies and the bureaucrats and assorted others. She actually took herself on the road. And in a sense, she went and talked to anybody who asked her. And, you know, for example, she got an invitation from a little country women's associations group, one up in Neil, you know, up on the border of Victoria. And, you know, she said to her sort of assistants, "Should I go?" And they said, no, it'll take all day, you know, and it'll take out a day. But she went. And when she went, there were hundreds of people that had been mobilised. And what that did was mobilise, you know, it wasn't just an opportunity for her to hear from all sorts of people about what the police could do better and what the police should be doing. But it gave an opportunity for them to start to gather support for this important activity of policing, which after all, you know, really, really needs to have the community as an active participant. So this question about vision is an important one. If you look at even indisputably great leaders like Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, they haven't told the people what they need. They've being careful to articulate some things that are very important to them and some ways in which they believe in people, but they haven't said, this is where you must go. In fact, they've done something quite different. They've been quite careful to keep on working at encouraging people to feel supported, to define that and do that work for themselves. I've got a little quote here for you from a fellow called Ron Heifetz, who's at the Kennedy School, who sort of captures this, and it's a rather long quote, so I'll sort of sum through it quickly. We call for someone with answers, decision strength, and a map of the future. Someone who knows where we ought to be going. Somebody who can make hard problems simple. But instead of looking for saviours, we should be looking for leadership that summons us to face the problems for which there are no simple, painless solutions. The challenges that require us to work in new ways. So liberating leadership looks a bit different from this great heroic model. It's necessarily a social process. It resists, or it may resist, the hunger that we often have for an answer or for certainty. It finds ways to support the group to do the work. It doesn't necessarily take the high moral ground and wait for everybody else to catch up. Sometimes it can be in very small or micro behaviours of really listening to somebody, of really paying attention when somebody is in need of some support. Sometimes it can be in the simple act of naming something that seems to be going on in your group or in your situation, but that nobody else has quite got the courage to name. So they're the sorts of leadership behaviours that I think we should be focusing on if we want our leadership to be more liberating. Third myth. This is the myth that leaders don't have dark sides. Well, all of the research tells us that the very ingredients of leadership, the drive, the energy, you know, the capacity to focus very single-mindedly, the charisma, all have dark sides. Part of our job as people who are interested in this area is to understand those dark sides in ourselves and others. All too often in the leadership literature, though, what happens, and we've seen this a lot in the Enron case, is that when somebody just sort of slips over the edge and is found to do something bad, as in the case of Jeff Skilling and the chairman, we describe them as a couple of baddies. You know, they weren't great leaders after all. We thought maybe they were for a little while, but, you know, they weren't. But this really fails, I believe. It stops us learning about the way that systemic conditions can foster conditions for bad leadership. So we really need to pay a lot more attention to the sort of conditions in which we all do get seduced, and the conditions that can often tip people into, across that fairly fine line it is, between leadership and psychopathology. It's not a huge jump, and we need to understand it better. So what can we do in this area? I think we really need to understand our own appetites for the answer, you know, for somebody to come over the hill and tell us, to deliver us from, you know, from the pain, from our suffering, from our difficulty, you know, mobilising things and getting things done. Now, look, you know, I could give you lots of examples of me, but I'm sure, you know, you can relate to this. We are all, for all sorts of reasons, we're all human. We hunger for approval. We hunger for certainty. We hunger for love. We hunger for belonging. That's part of our nature as humans. The challenge for leaders is to come to understand that about themselves, at least a bit. So that when we're in situations where we are influencing others, or we have the opportunity to support others, that we're not playing out our own stuff, or not too much anyway. That we can be, as I describe, a little bit less ego leaders, a little bit less captured by our own stuff and more focused on connection and working with others. I think part of this is also about keeping a really clear sense of priorities, so that when you hear yourself put your life on hold again, you know, when you hear yourself saying, I'll just get through this particular one, you know, I'll just get over this particular set of demands, I'll just get through this particular set of difficulties, then I'll have the time to spend with the people who really matter, to do the things that really count. When you hear yourself saying that, stop and ask yourself what's going on. So that anchoring back to the things that really matter is very important. All, of course, with great compassion for yourself, because we're all learners in this. Great compassion for yourself and others. Next myth, that diversity, gender and bodies are irrelevant in leadership. I was on a panel just recently with a very eminent business leader who said that gender's over as an issue in leadership. It was a bit hard for me, you can imagine, not responding to that one. Now, he went on to say that all sorts of other issues were now important. So diversity issues, Indigenous issues were all race, all important in leadership. Now, of course, they are. But what that view reflects is a very common misconception, and that is that members of minority groups simply need to adapt to the norms and expectations of the dominant leadership approach rather than challenge it. This view is very, very pervasive out there in leadership circles, and in particular in business leadership circles. It's a view that's sometimes called the pipeline approach. It just says, well, we just need to wait for all those people who don't quite look like us to catch up. We just need to wait for them to get the right experience, the right, whether it's line management experience or whether it's right geographical experience, we just need to get them to build their confidence and their competence, and then they'll move into leadership roles. Well, it's a ploy, and it needs to be named as a ploy. It's a defence, and it doesn't work. All of the evidence that we have available to us now tells us that there are still very many barriers to people who don't look like the norm in leadership roles. And it's not a matter of there not being good people out there with the appropriate level of training and experience, good people who can do the job. So this expectation that you just wait really needs to be confronted. And we also need to confront that when people who don't look like the norm try to behave like the norm, then they often run into more difficulties. So there's a very expensive and well-publicised lawsuit in the US a year or so ago against PricewaterhouseCoopers, where a senior woman partner was successful because she claimed that she learned to do exactly what she saw her male colleagues do. She reproduced their behaviour to the letter, and she was discriminated on that basis because she was then seen to be trying to be too much like one of the boys. And it was offensive when a woman was doing it. Of course. So you can see that this is sort of tricky for those of us who don't look like the norm. The sort of feedback that women in leadership roles often get are, firstly, that they're not confident enough, so they need to do assertiveness training. They remind people of their mothers or their kindergarten teachers. I've had that a lot. I've been very bossy, very pushy, very prying, very controlling, very manipulative, all of those sorts of things. Women often get the advice that they need a makeover. And what's that mean? In the environments that I will move in, it means only ever wearing a navy suit or a black suit, always wearing stockings and that high heels. Not too high, not too low. Women get feedback that they make people uncomfortable and that they're scary. And the more power they have, the scarier they are. Can I just give you a little anecdote from my own experience? This is when I was first starting to not been in the business school all that long. I was teaching sort of reasonably large groups of mainly men. And on this particular program, I was teaching to a management for engineers program. So you can imagine the group. It was about 40 blokes, and there were two women in the group, and they were in camouflage. And I'd been watching my colleagues, because when I first started teaching in this situation, I was very unsuccessful. It was really tough. Often my students would, they'd come in to do battle with me. So I'd watch my colleagues and I'd watched how they do, how really well-evaluated teachers taught. And so I'd watch them. And, what they'd do is they'd come into the lecture theatre and they'd sort of look around and then they'd start and undress. They'd sort of start and loosen the tie. And they might throw that to one side. And then they'd take off their jacket. And then they'd roll their sleeves up. And this was all about getting down to work. They'd also use their bodies in this way. They would stride around the lecture theatre. They'd walk up and down the aisles. They'd look people close in the eye. They would use their physical body in a very, very powerful way. So I thought, right. And here I was, management for engineers. I walked in, started to get down to business. And this is what happens when you... And you can imagine, I threw the jacket to one side and I looked up and there was complete horror. What will she do next? Where will she? So, what this told me in a very mortifying way was that when women do the same things that men do, those actions are read differently. And that applies to leadership. And it doesn't just, of course, apply to women. It applies to men who don't look like the norm. It applies to men with different backgrounds who don't quite fit the standard. All sorts of additional expectations, unconscious stereotypes come into play. So part of the leadership work around this is in not just colluding with that, but in naming it. In inspecting our own reactions, in challenging it, in opening up the space for greater diversity in leadership. Now, I want to just show you a couple of clips to explore this a bit further. The two clips are of two Australian leaders that I've studied, and the first one is of Christine Nixon. And the second one is of Chris Sara, who's, for those of you who don't know, an Indigenous school principal in Queensland who won Queenslander of the Year in 2004 for some of his very amazingly innovative practices that he introduced in Cherbourg State School, which is a former mission area with very, very bad educational outcomes. Now, I'll show the two back to back. The first one is about 2 minutes, the other one is about 4 minutes. But I want you to, in particular, pay attention to these two very different bodies, these two very different leadership bodies, and in particular, how those bodies support the work of leadership. So in both cases, what we see here are leaders who have brought about really quite radical change in very moribund systems, in systems, organisations, environments that other people had given up on ever getting much change in. So perhaps I'll ask for those to be played now, and we'll just have them back to back.
When I was asked by the members of the police gay and lesbian community, would I allow them to wear uniforms in the Gay Pride March? Seemed to me like that was fine. I didn't see any problem about that at all. And then they asked me when I marched, and again, I didn't see any issues. It was about supporting my members who were doing a great job in their work. What I was really surprised about was the response from the community.
I think it's an error of judgment to bring the New South Wales standards to Victoria. I think that these sort of activities, the police commissioner should be above these sort of activities.
I just was shocked. For a community like Melbourne, and it just seemed to me surprising that this issue was one that so many people had an opinion on and wanted to talk about. It was something that I think people took a little bit out of context, I thought, and perhaps used it for inappropriate reasons.
She's interested in policing, but she's also interested in how it fits with everything else. And she's got a mind which makes lots of connections and doesn't necessarily fall for the first and most obvious cause. She's always looking behind it.
What disturbed me the most was that he's the biggest, toughest kid in the whole school. Would rather create a scene and run the risk of getting kicked out of school than admit to me that he just couldn't read. And I saw his father a couple of years after that and said, "How's he going?" And he said, "Oh, he's in jail." And I genuinely fear the day that somebody's come to me and said, "Oh, this kid's been found hanged in a cell, or he's died from petrol sniffing or something like that, you know." Because he just couldn't read, you know, and it wasn't his fault. And what bothered me was that all of this was being tolerated. And when I'd asked the staff that I'd inherited, you know, why is it that I'm seeing such dramatic underachievement in our school? Why is the school such an awful place? Their response was, well, the department doesn't support us, or there's many social complexities. And I sat in this room here a long time ago and said, look, what I believe, what the elders in our community believe, is that our children can leave here with academic outcomes that are just as good as any other school in Queensland, and that they can leave here with a very strong and very positive sense of what it means to be Aboriginal. And if you don't believe it, then it's time for you to go. And half the teaching staff got up and left.
If the teachers didn't believe that the children could learn, then he needed a staff that actually believed in what the children could do. I had started with pretty much a whole new staff. There was about six of us that had came on board in 2000.
Who looks after Sherbert?
Look, Della, boy.
Who looks after Sherbert? Who's that fella down in the council building?
New, young, enthusiastic people who were determined to go the extra mile to help the kids. They came on board and he created a team.
What are you drawing?
I'm drawing a turtle.
A turtle. What are you drawing, Michael?
Emu.
Emu, okay.
Things changed a lot more quickly than I expected them to at the start. We came out firing with the strong and smart vision and high expectations of children.
Good morning, everybody. What an exciting week it's been this week. I've had people from all over the place ring me up asking me about the Schoenberg School because they heard it was the school that was...
One of the first changes that was made at the school was the absenteeism. Some afternoons you might have only had 6 or 8 children in the classroom. You may have had 15, 17 in the morning.
We've got nearly half of the school with 0 unexplained absences. So congratulations to you, because coming to school every day is the thing that's going to make you the thing that we say, which is...
And doesn't it Chris decided to implement a reward system for children who attended school regularly. The class with the lowest number of absenteeism would win an ice block, and then at the end of the term, if they had missed 5 days or less, they would go to McDonald's.
Well, the strong that we talk about in Strong and Smart means that you have to be strong enough to say no to other people when they try to drag you away from school.
That's Some people say that bribing children doesn't work. Well, I'm here to tell you that it does work.
The winner of free lunch is...
Kalina!
Kalina! Where is she?
The number of unexplained absences in Term 3, 2000, was 1,185. In Term 4, 2001, the number of unexplained absences was 68.5. At some point, we had to get down to business, and the strong and smart that we talked about in our school, it had to translate to the real deal. And the real deal in any school is results on paper.
Can you read that for me? Why not? You're just copying it down. Well, what's the good of that then?
It meant I had to ride kids pretty hard and make them get to class.
This place is supposed to sound like a classroom. Sounds like a place where people are just talking too much. Let's settle down and get back to the work that we're supposed to be doing.
If they played up in class and stopped other children from learning, I growled them, you know. Or I would go and see the parents and say, look, your kid's playing up. We're trying to change where we're going with the school. We need your help.
Fold your page in half.
It was just this huge turnaround. The learning was happening, the children were here and they wanted to be here. And it was functioning like a normal school.
And then on the other side, Mum growls him.
The children at Schoenberg have, in fact, improved dramatically in developing their literacy and numeracy. We've conducted a major review into the achievements there, and there's no doubt that Chris's leadership of a solid team has led to those significant improvements.
But if you did show tolerance, then you wouldn't be burning up all the time and getting wild, eh?
I like school because it's giving me education. And you get more smarter.
You know what you're doing there? Go on, let's have a crack. Between the numbers you have chosen.
I like doing my work. Good education. Every day I walk down the street. Strong and smart means not putting yourself down and learning every day.
Does it feel good to be able to read like that?
I like the school better than any other school.
Okay. So two really interesting examples of leadership there. But in particular, the thing I asked you to take note of was the bodywork of leadership. Just taking Christine for a moment. I don't know if you noticed, she was marching out of time there. She was out of time. She literally had to get the uniform specially made because it didn't fit her. Now, if it doesn't fit her, who else doesn't it fit, you know? So, you know, in all sorts of interesting ways, she empowered the police to have more flexibility about their uniform, to give them more choice about what they wore. But, you know, part of that was also opening up the police force to a very different body of people. She told me recently that one of the most moving things was that at a recent graduation, the father of a police officer just graduated. So fascinating sort of ideas about recruiting the police from all age ranges and all parts of the community are part of opening up this body of the police to be more diverse and more open. her own insistence, I mean, this was a big thing to do, you know, to actually go to the gay and Mardi Gras march. So what? She was in her very presence. She was also doing some things there which were affirming to the gay members of the police force, apart from anything else, but also positioning herself in that community and saying, we value you. We think you're important. And I'm going to be here, physically. Was quite striking. Turning to Sarah, in an interestingly different set of problems. I mean, his problem as a teacher was the absence of bodies. The kids were just dreadfully, dreadfully absent. And so what he did to help that was to pay attention to their physical well-being. So he made sure that they were looked after, that the buildings were not vandalised, that he paid attention to their bodies and encouraged them to value them, as well as their mind, of course. But you'll notice the strong and smart vision that he talks about a lot, strong and smart. So there's a sense there in which the body's also being privileged. And he says that that is an important part of the way he goes about being a leader is because of his Aboriginality, and that that's part of his Aboriginal heritage. So two interesting examples of people who have not gone into camouflage. Chris in particular, he talked a little bit about growling as a form of disciplinary measure with kids who are acting up. He got into trouble. Growling involves getting up close with kids and raising your voice. You know, making a bit of a scene, making them understand that this is really serious and really big time. And he says, look, you know, this is infinitely better for me than banning them from school. I mean, this is the worst out, you know, that's the worst thing I want to do. So, but it's been controversial. And you, as you saw with Christine too, marching in the gay parade got her in trouble. The opposition leader. Liberating leadership in this way, challenging the norms, making space for different sorts of bodies to come in to do the work of leadership, does involve risk. It involves courage. And I urge you all in that direction. Now, the final myth that I want to finish on is that leadership should focus on achieving future material goals. Now, I think we often get caught up in our leadership work around striving towards goals. It seems to be, a really inevitable part of the process of becoming institutionalised or becoming part of a group, that you've got to think ahead, you've got to plan. But, you know, I think we need to be really conscious of not just being captured by that. And I do it myself all the time. You know, I think I can put things on hold. I think I can put my family, my life, my health on hold, you know, until I just get through this particular subject or teaching period or whatever it might be. But a lot of, I suppose, my recent work has been around encouraging people not to lose sight of the present, to be in the moment more, to see value in the connections that we're making right at this very moment. I've been teaching yoga at the business school as well as my other subjects. And look, it's easily, I'm sure it's far and away the most valuable thing I do. Because, you know, you see people, you know, they stagger into the room at lunchtime, you know, they're exhausted, they've gone all out to get there, and then you see over the next hour, just with a little bit of encouragement to nurture themselves, to slow down, to remember what's important, you just see them kind of shedding some burdens, loosening up, releasing themselves. And you see them later and they look just better, happier, more able to do the work that they need to do. So it's a really important thing to find a way of bringing that discipline into your work. And what I want you to do actually now, I want us to do a little exercise which involves this. So what I'd like you to do is to turn around and find somebody sitting behind you that you don't know. And just for about 3 or 4 minutes, I want you to introduce yourself to them, or, you know, introduce yourself to each other, and just say a few things about the leadership work that you're doing right now. Thank you. I wanted to finish with that that exercise really as a way of underlying, you know, my belief that listening and acknowledging the work that we are doing and that others around us are doing in leadership is a central part of liberating leadership. And to urge you not to get too caught up in the future in a way that stops you experiencing that right now. The Buddhists would say that, you know, getting caught up with planning and all that sort of stuff is really getting caught up in illusion. And it induces needless suffering. And we're all familiar with that. There really is only the present. And it's very important to stop and value it. So thank you very much for letting me be part of it.